Welcome to the History Maps podcast. We are doing a deep dive into the source material today, tracing the evolution of the Kingdom of Nepal.
Right, and it is a fascinating topic to really dig into.
Yeah, it really is. Because usually when you look at a map of Nepal today, you just accept the borders as these fixed, permanent lines.
Right, you just see the finished product.
Exactly, the finished product.
Mm-hmm.
But those lines were actually drawn through centuries of deliberate isolation, violent social engineering, and sheer geopolitical survival.
Yeah, survival is really the key word there.
We are going to trace how a highly fragmented Himalayan region was forged into a unified state, how it endured a century locked behind what was basically an iron curtain of oligarchy, and how it eventually transitioned into a modern federal republic following a decade-long civil war.
And to understand how those borders were drawn, we really have to recognize that the history of this region is, well, it's a masterclass in extreme statecraft dictated by unforgiving geography.
Geography really is destiny here, right?
I mean, absolutely. The Himalayas are not just mountains. They are this massive geological wall that dictates trade routes, military logistics, and cultural exchange.
So when we look at the mid-18th century, we are definitely not looking at a unified nation.
No, not at all. You were looking at a deeply fractured landscape. It was composed of 54 microscopic, highly distinct principalities.
54 separate states packed into that mountainous terrain. That sounds less like a political system and more like a permanent state of localized warfare.
It was an incredibly volatile environment. So in the Western Hills, you had confederacies known as the Beys and Shobis Raja.
Which literally means the 22 and 24 principalities, right?
Exactly. And these were rugged, highly militarized hill states that were just constantly shifting alliances.
And then what about the South and East?
Right. To the South and East were the Sen states, and they controlled these vital forested lowlands. But the true prize of the entire region was the Kathmandu Valley.
Because it was ruled by the wealthy Mola kings.
Yeah, and the valley was an agricultural anomaly. It was fertile, relatively flat, and perfectly positioned to control the highly lucrative trans-Himalayan trade.
We're talking about the trade of salt, wool, and manufactured goods moving between Tibet and India.
Precisely. So whoever controls the Kathmandu Valley essentially controls the economic heartbeat of the entire central Himalayas.
But the kingdom that eventually takes it over, Gorkha, isn't one of these wealthy trading hubs, is it?
No, not at all. It is a relatively poor, austere state up in the hills.
And this is where Prithvi Narayan Shah enters the picture.
Yes, the architect of unity.
Right. He is born in Gorkha on January 11, 1723, and his background seems to directly influence the unification campaign he later launches.
It absolutely does. His stepmother, Queen Chandra Prabhawati, handles his early upbringing, and she takes a highly calculated approach.
She basically shields him from the political decadence that was common in the surrounding royal courts, doesn't she?
Yeah, she deliberately isolated him. The princes in neighboring states like Tanahun, Lamjung, and Kaleski were heavily involved in internal factionalism and luxurious lifestyles.
Funded by localized taxation, presumably.
Right. So Queen Chandra Prabhawati kept Prithvi Narayan Shah away from that environment, instilling this very severe martial discipline instead.
Which is paramount, because when he ascends the throne of Gorkha in 1743 at the age of 20, he inherits a kingdom that lacks wealth, but possesses a highly disciplined military culture.
Exactly. And that discipline was immediately tested because his initial military campaign was actually a failure.
He didn't just march out of Gorkha and start conquering everything.
Right. No, his first target was Nuwakot, which was a critical fortress town guarding the western trade route into the Kathmandu Valley.
And he loses that battle.
He's repelled because the Gorkha forces were relying on traditional outdated weaponry.
Swords, bows, and rudimentary local firearms.
Yeah, and they were up against much better entrenched defenders. But the reaction to this defeat is what separates a minor hill chieftain from a true state builder.
Because he recognizes a fatal logistical flaw.
Right. He completely halts his military campaign and travels south to Benares.
Which was a major intellectual and commercial hub in India at the time. Going to Benares wasn't just a diplomatic trip, though. It was an arms procurement mission.
Completely. He recognized that discipline alone could not defeat fortified positions, so he purchased modern matchlock and flintlock muskets.
And crucially, he brings back skilled armorers and craftsmen to Gorkha so they can manufacture their own munitions.
Exactly. He spends a year entirely retraining his infantry to fight in coordinated formations.
And that modernization of the military apparatus really changes the balance of power in the hills.
It does. When he returns to attack Nua Khat in 1744, he takes the fortress.
Which gives Gorkha a foothold on the edge of the Kathmandu Valley?
Yeah, and over the next two decades, we see a slow, methodical encirclement.
A critical moment occurs in 1762 at the Battle of Makwanpur, right?
Yes, that was a grueling 8-hour engagement fought over the southern gateways to the valley. Capturing Makwanpur allowed Gorkha to sever the primary trade arteries connecting the Kathmandu Valley to the plains of India.
Which brings us to a strategy for actually taking the valley itself. The Mala kings in Kathmandu, Patan, and Bhaktapur had massive defensive walls, wealth, and population advantages.
So a direct brute force assault on those cities would have likely exhausted the Gorkha army.
Right. So instead, his approach functioned a bit like a boa constrictor.
That is a great analogy. The geographical layout of the Kathmandu Valley makes it highly susceptible to isolation if you can control the surrounding ridges.
And Prithvi Narayan Shah systematically captures that high ground and institutes a severe, multi-year economic blockade.
He chokes off the flow of grain, salt, and trade goods. He literally criminalizes any smuggling into the valley.
He essentially starves out the wealthiest cities in the region.
Yeah, and this economic warfare culminates in the capture of Kirtipur in 1766, which was a notoriously brutal siege.
Followed by the fall of Kathmandu in 1768, and finally Bhaktapur in 1769.
Right, the Mala kings were deposed, and the Gorkha kingdom became the unified kingdom of Nepal, with Kathmandu as its new capital.
But looking at the timeline, we are in the mid to late 18th century. Down in the Indian subcontinent, the British East India Company is rapidly transitioning from a trading corporation into an aggressive territorial empire.
Right. They're expanding fast.
So was Prithvi Narayan Shah's unification campaign driven purely by ambition and a desire to conquer those wealthy trade hubs? Or was this a calculated defensive reaction to what was happening in India?
It is a critical distinction to make when you look at the sources. While control of the Trans-Himalayan wealth was an immediate objective, the geopolitical foresight demonstrated in his final text points heavily toward a defensive necessity.
You mean the Divyopadesh?
Exactly. When he was dying in the winter of 1775 in Nua Khat, he delivered this monologue to his ministers. He famously told them that their nation is a yam situated between two boulders.
The boulders being the Qing Empire of China to the north, and the British East India Company to the south.
Right. He explicitly understood the mechanism of British imperial expansion. The East India Company was systematically exploiting divisions between the various Indian princely states, pitting them against one another and absorbing them piecemeal.
So he realizes that 54 squabbling Himalayan principalities would be consumed effortlessly.
Precisely. The unification was a preemptive consolidation of geography and manpower.
He was building a sovereign buffer state.
Yes, a state with enough strategic depth, mountainous terrain, unified command, and centralized resources to make a British invasion prohibitively expensive.
Which explains his intense paranoia about foreign influence in the Divyopadesh. He actively discourages foreign merchants, bans foreign missionaries, and warns that where the merchant goes, the musket inevitably follows.
He wanted to keep the economy entirely self-reliant.
But after he dies in 1775, that philosophy of cautious consolidation seems to just disappear.
It really does. Under his successors, specifically during the regency of Prince Bahadur Shah in the 1780s and 90s, the Gorkha military apparatus goes into overdrive.
They push the borders westward across the mountains, all the way to the Sutlej River, and eastward to the Teesta River.
The machinery of the newly unified state was heavily militarized. You see, the Gorkha army operated on a system of land grants called jagir,
where officers and soldiers were paid with newly conquered agricultural land.
Right. And this created a structural necessity for continuous outward expansion just to fund the military.
But this aggressive expansion invariably brings them into direct contact with larger imperial spheres of influence.
It does. The first major friction point happens to the north.
In the late 1780s, the Gorkha forces make armed incursions into Tibet.
Which triggers the Sino-Nepalese War, running from 1788 to 1792.
But the root cause of this war wasn't just territorial ambition, was it? The sources indicate it was a highly technical dispute over macroeconomics, specifically the purity of silver coinage.
Yeah, it is a fascinating detail. The Mala kings of the Kathmandu Valley had historically minted silver coins that were used as the primary currency in Tibet.
But during the final years of the Mala reign, They had debased the currency, mixing base metals into the silver to fund their wars against the Gorkhas.
Right. So when Prithvi Narayan Shah conquered the valley, he minted pure silver coins and demanded that Tibet recall the old debased coins at a one-to-one exchange rate.
And Tibet naturally refuses to take the economic loss.
Exactly. This dispute escalates, leading the Gorkha army to cross the Himalayas and sack Tibetan monastic centers.
But you cannot just invade Tibet without drawing the attention of the Qing dynasty in China. Tibet was a protectorate of the Qing Empire.
And the Qing Emperor, Qianlong, mobilizes a massive military response.
Marching a large imperial army across the Tibetan plateau and down into the treacherous passes of the Himalayas is a logistical nightmare.
Oh, absolutely. But the Qing forces managed to push the Gorkha army all the way back to the outskirts of the Kathmandu Valley.
The conflict ends with the Treaty of Betrawadi in 1792.
Right, and Nepal was forced to establish a tributary relationship with China, sending missions to Beijing every 5 years.
It served as a definitive hard stop to any further Nepali expansion northward.
It did. So, blocked to the north by the Qing Empire, the martial energy of the Gorkha state is redirected southward and westward.
And this is where they run headlong into the British East India Company.
And tensions had been steadily rising over the Terai, the fertile forested lowlands along the southern border.
Because the British wanted the Terai for its lucrative timber, which they needed for shipbuilding and railway sleepers.
Right. And they also desperately wanted to force open the trade routes through the Himalayas into Tibet.
This mutual friction erupts into the Anglo-Nepalese War, which lasts from 1814 to 1816.
The East India Company invaded with overwhelming numerical superiority and advanced artillery. They really expected a swift victory.
Instead, they encountered severe logistical nightmares.
Yeah, moving heavy artillery through steep, forested ravines was nearly impossible, and they faced a highly motivated, deeply entrenched opponent.
The Nepalese forces utilized guerrilla tactics, constructed complex hillside stockades, and fought with intense ferocity.
You had legendary commanders like Amar Singh Thapa holding key western forts against British generals like David Ochterlony.
The war was a brutal war of attrition.
It was. And it finally concludes with the Treaty of Sugali, signed on March 4, 1816.
And the terms seem devastating on paper. Nepal is forced to cede roughly one-third of its total territory.
Right, losing Kuman, Garhwal, and large sections of the Terai Plains.
They established their permanent eastern and western boundaries at the Mechi and Mahakali rivers. And they also have to accept a British resident diplomat in Kathmandu.
Which is exactly the kind of foreign entanglement Prithvi Narayan Shah had explicitly warned against.
So, reading the source material, you have to ask, did the Gorkha kingdom simply overreach? Did they stretch their military and administrative logistics so thin across the Himalayas that they triggered their own containment by an empire they could never realistically defeat?
It is the classic paradox of rapid imperial expansion. They expanded to secure their borders, but that very expansion destabilized the frontier of a much larger empire.
The British East India Company just could not tolerate a highly militarized expansionist power threatening their alliances in northern India.
Exactly. However, we must contextualize the Treaty of Sugali. Losing a third of their land was a severe blow. But consider the fate of the Maratha Empire, the Sikh Empire, and dozens of other heavily armed states in India.
They were entirely conquered, dismantled, and fully colonized by the British.
Right. By fighting the East India Company to a grinding, expensive standstill in the hills, Nepal made full colonization unappealing.
They lost territory, but they crucially retained their internal independence and sovereign monarchy.
They secured their status as a necessary buffer state between British India and King China.
And that war produces one of the most enduring, pragmatic arrangements in military history.
You were talking about the Gurkhas.
Yeah. Because during the conflict, British officers were so struck by the discipline and resilience of the Nepalese troops that, before the war was even officially over, they began enlisting them.
In 1815, the first regiments of Gurkha soldiers were incorporated into the British Indian Army.
And that recruitment pipeline transforms a military defeat into a socioeconomic lifeline, doesn't it?
It does. The British gained access to highly effective infantry drawn from the rugged hill communities people accustomed to extreme hardship.
In return, Nepal gains a diplomatic lever. By supplying the British military with soldiers, the Nepali rulers proved their continued usefulness to the empire.
Right, ensuring the British had no incentive to further encroach on their remaining territory.
Furthermore, The wages and pensions earned by these soldiers became a vital source of foreign currency for the rural hill economy.
Absolutely. So externally, the state survives. They establish this tense equilibrium with the British to the south and the Chinese to the north.
But with the borders now fixed, all of that aggressive militaristic energy that had fueled the unification and expansion has nowhere left to go.
Right. The external pressure cooker is sealed.
And the kingdom begins to fracture violently from the inside. Following the Treaty of Sugali, the Kathmandu court descends into severe factionalism.
You have young or weak Shah kings on the throne and powerful aristocratic families, primarily the Thapas and the Pandes, engaging in a relentless, blood-soaked struggle for the position of Muktiar.
The prime minister.
Yeah. When you remove the unifying objective of outward expansion, the military aristocracy turns inward to compete for finite state resources.
The political instability of the early 19th century was characterized by assassinations, forced exiles, and constant palace intrigue.
The monarchy was too weak to control the military factions, and the military factions were too divided to govern effectively.
This structural chaos created a massive power vacuum.
One that was eventually filled with ruthless efficiency on a single night.
That night is September 15, 1846. The event is recorded in the sources as the Kut Massacre.
Right. A rising, deeply ambitious military commander named Jung Bahadur Kunwar manages to manipulate the paranoia of the queen.
He engineers a gathering of the entire court establishment at the Kut Armory Courtyard.
Because the queen had called the assembly to investigate the assassination of her favored minister, the courtyard was packed with unarmed ministers, regional chieftains, and royal relatives.
But Jung Bahadur had his own heavily armed loyalists stationed at the exits.
Yeah. And when an argument inevitably broke out in that tense atmosphere, violence erupted. The courtyard doors were locked.
In the ensuing slaughter, Jung Bahadur's forces eliminated over 30 of the most powerful political figures in the kingdom.
The Thapa and Pandey factions were essentially decapitated in a few hours.
It is a complete purge of the political elite. And Jung Bahadur doesn't just take power. He completely rewrites the operational code of the monarchy.
He immediately takes the title of Prime Minister and Commander-in-Chief. But he takes it a step further.
He extracts a royal decree that makes his position hereditary.
Right. The prime ministership will no longer be appointed by the king. It will pass down through the Rana family line.
From brother to brother, and then to their sons. This establishes the Rana dynasty. But what actually happens to the king? What happens to the descendants of Prithvi Narayan Shah?
Well, the Shah monarchs are subjected to a highly formalized system of political imprisonment.
The sources describe it almost like a gilded cage.
That is exactly what it was. They are kept in luxurious confinement within their palaces, completely isolated from the military, the administration, and the public.
They are maintained purely as religious and ceremonial figureheads.
Right. Necessary to legitimize the state, but stripped of all executive authority.
And the Ranas rule as absolute oligarchs, operating the country essentially as a private family estate. This system lasts for 104 years.
From 1846 all the way to 1951.
The Ranas institute a policy of extreme isolationism. They close the borders to almost all foreigners.
They refuse to build roads connecting Kathmandu to the outside world.
And they keep national literacy rates below 5%.
Yeah, deliberately starving the population of education to prevent the spread of liberal or democratic ideas that were beginning to circulate in British India.
The taxation on the peasantry is crushing. The state frequently extracts up to 50% of agricultural produce simply to fund the lavish neoclassical palaces the Ranas are building for themselves in Kathmandu.
And they maintain this control through a very calculated dual policy.
Externally, they guaranteed their security through total strategic compliance with the British Empire.
Yes. During the Indian Rebellion of 1857, Jung Bahadur Rana personally led thousands of Nepali troops to assist the British in violently suppressing the uprising in Lucknow.
Which is incredibly pragmatic. I mean, they're isolationists, yet they deploy their own military to protect the colonial power next door.
It was a transaction. In exchange for saving British interests during the mutiny, the British returned a large tract of fertile Terai land that had been lost in the Sugali Treaty.
An area known as the Naya Muluk, or New Country.
Right. And the British were perfectly content to leave the Ranas to their absolute rule as long as Nepal remained a stable buffer state.
supplying reliable Gurkha recruits and refusing to harbor anti-British revolutionaries.
Exactly. But military force and foreign backing alone cannot control a geographically fractured, highly diverse population for a century.
To maintain internal stability, the Ranas required a system of social control that penetrated every village and every household.
Which brings us to their most powerful and insidious tool of statecraft.
In 1854, young Bahadur Rana promulgates the Muluki Ain, the National Civil Code.
On the surface, it is just a consolidation of laws. But when you examine its mechanics, it is a massive, legally codified framework of social engineering.
It takes 64 distinct ethnic, linguistic, and social groups living within the borders of Nepal and forcibly categorizes them into a rigid four-tier caste hierarchy,
based strictly on Hindu concepts of ritual purity.
Now, Muluki Ain wasn't just a religious text, though, was it?
No, it was the ultimate instrument of state centralization. Prior to this code, the vast diversity of the Himalayan communities, many of whom were Buddhist, animist, or practiced indigenous shamanism, operated under their own localized customary laws.
The Rana regime needed a unified legal structure to administer the state efficiently.
And to solidify their own position at the absolute pinnacle of society. So they utilize the vocabulary of Hindu ritual purity to justify a strict socioeconomic hierarchy.
Let's break down how this hierarchy actually functioned, because it dictated the lived reality of every single citizen. At the very top of the pyramid were the Tagadhari,
the wearers of the sacred thread.
This category included the high caste Parbatiya groups, primarily the Brahmins and Kshatriyas,
which is the demographic that the Rana family itself belonged to.
Under the Muluki Ain, the Tagadhari held an absolute monopoly on all administrative, military, and judicial power.
More critically, they were granted massive legal immunities. They were legally exempt from capital punishment, regardless of the crime, and their lands could not be confiscated by the state.
The code basically legally enshrined inequality.
It did. Beneath the Tagadhari was the second tier, known as the Madawali, or alcohol drinkers.
And this massive demographic encompassed the indigenous ethnic groups of the hills and plains, communities we now refer to as Janajatis.
But the state didn't just group them together, it subdivided them based on their utility to the regime.
Right. The law split the Madawali into two specific subcategories, the non-enslavable and the enslavable.
The non-enslavable Madawali included groups like the Gurung and Magar. These were the communities that provided the bulk of the soldiers for both the Rana army and the British Gurkha regiments.
So the state needed them loyal and fighting, so they were protected from enslavement.
Exactly. But beneath them were the enslavable Matawali, which included ethnic groups with Tibetan cultural and linguistic affinities, such as the Tamang and the Boat.
The codification of who could be legally enslaved as punishment for crimes or debt is a stark indicator of how the law was used to extract labor.
The state required massive amounts of forced, unpaid labor, known as jahara, to build infrastructure, carry goods across the mountains, and serve the military.
By legally categorizing certain marginalized ethnic groups as enslavable, the regime guaranteed a permanent, legally sanctioned underclass to perform this labor without compensation.
Right. Now, the third tier of the Muluki Ain is perhaps the most revealing about the pragmatic nature of this law.
The code classifies a specific group of people as impure but touchable, and this category included European foreigners and Muslims.
It is a fascinating detail. You have this rigid framework based on Hindu purity, but the geopolitical reality is that the Ranas have to conduct diplomacy with British envoys and engage in commerce with Kashmiri Muslim merchants.
So they basically created a loophole.
It is a brilliant, if cynical, piece of legal maneuvering. If the Ranas classified the powerful British diplomats as untouchable, they would be unable to interact with them, host them in their palaces, or conduct the diplomacy necessary to secure their own regime.
By creating a distinct legal category of impure but touchable, the ruling elite could conduct necessary state business with foreigners without violating their own prescribed ritual purity, and without elevating those foreigners to the status of the ruling caste.
Exactly. And at the very bottom of this legal pyramid were the untouchable Dalits.
This tier included highly skilled occupational groups like the Kami, who were blacksmiths, the Damai, who were tailors and musicians, and the Sarki, who were leather workers.
Despite their crucial economic roles, the Muluki Ain subjected them to severe systemic marginalization.
They were legally prohibited from entering temples, excluded from using public water sources, and barred from attaining any position of authority.
The enforcement mechanisms of the code were entirely asymmetrical.
Meaning the punishments for crimes were dictated not by the severity of the act, but by the caste of the perpetrator and the victim.
Right. If a lower caste individual committed a crime against a higher caste individual, the punishment was draconian, often mutilation or death.
But if a higher caste individual committed the same crime against a lower caste person, the penalty was just a minimal fine.
And the laws regarding marriage, sexual relations, and commensality, who could share food and water with whom, were strictly monitored by state courts to prevent any blurring of the hierarchy.
How does a relatively small ruling elite in Kathmandu manage to enforce this incredibly intrusive legal code across thousands of isolated mountain villages where communication takes weeks?
They weaponized the local elites.
Oh, yeah.
The Rana administration appointed local headmen in the villages to collect taxes and maintain order. These headmen were integrated into the state apparatus and benefited from enforcing the hierarchy.
Furthermore, the sheer brutality of the punishments for violating the code served as an effective deterrent.
The Maluki Ains successfully intertwined religious doctrine with property rights and physical survival.
It created a society where everyone was hyper-aware of their exact legal status relative to everyone else, preventing any broad cross-ethnic solidarity that could threaten the regime.
But, you know, no isolation lasts forever. By the mid-20th century, the geopolitical landscape shifts dramatically.
Right. In 1947, the British Empire withdraws from India.
And the Ranas lose their primary external guarantor of security.
Newly independent India, operating as a democratic republic, has absolutely no interest in supporting an autocratic, isolationist oligarchy on its northern border.
This external shift catalyzes the internal opposition. Nepali dissidents who had been educated in India, many of whom had participated in the Indian independence movement, formed the Nepali Congress Party.
They recognized that the Rana regime was structurally vulnerable.
So in 1950, they launched an armed insurrection. But the crucial turning point involved the institution that had been imprisoned for a century, the monarchy.
King Tribhuvan, the reigning Shah monarch, does something unprecedented.
He manages to escape his palace guards, seeks asylum in the Indian embassy in Kathmandu, and is subsequently flown to New Delhi.
He openly aligns the legitimacy of the crown with the democratic insurgents.
And the Rana regime, facing armed rebellion in the provinces and immense diplomatic pressure from India, simply collapses.
This leads to the Delhi Compromise of 1951, which strips the Ranas of their hereditary power and restores sovereign authority to the Shah king.
But the fall of the Ranas initiated a decade of profound political instability.
Because the country had virtually no modern infrastructure, a tiny educated middle class, and no history of democratic institutions.
There was a brief attempt to establish a constitutional monarchy. This culminated in the general elections of 1959, where the Nepali Congress, led by B.P. Koirala, won a decisive victory and formed a government.
B.P. Koirala is attempting to modernize the state, initiate land reforms, and curtail the traditional privileges of the aristocracy.
But he is operating under a constitution that leaves significant emergency powers in the hands of the monarch.
And the new monarch, King Mahendra, who ascended the throne in 1955, has very different ideas about how the Pal should be governed.
On December 15, 1960, King Mahendra utilizes the military to execute a royal coup.
The logistics of the coup were swift and absolute.
King Mahendra dismissed the elected parliament, ordered the army to arrest Prime Minister Koirala and his cabinet, banned all political parties, and suspended the constitution.
He cited corruption, inefficiency, and the failure of the democratic government to maintain national unity as his justification.
He essentially hits the reset button on the democratic experiment.
But he knows he cannot just reinstate the absolute isolationism of the Ranas. The world has modernized. He needs a political system that looks participatory but functions autocratically.
So in 1962, he introduces the Panchayat system.
And King Mahendra actively rejected the Western model of multi-party democracy, right?
Yeah, he argued that it inherently fostered division and factionalism in a developing nation. He claimed the Panchayat system was a guided democracy that was naturally suited to the soil of Nepal, rooted in traditional village councils.
But if you look closely at how a Panchayat system actually operated in the sources, it functions like an elaborate political ventriloquist act.
It was a four-tier pyramidal structure. At the absolute base, you had the village or town assemblies, which elected local councils.
These local councils give the distinct illusion of grassroots democracy. The villagers are casting votes.
But those local councils only elected representatives to the district tier. The district members then elected the zonal assemblies.
And finally, the zonal assemblies acted as electoral colleges to select members for the national legislature, the Rashtriya Panchayat.
By utilizing indirect elections through multiple tiers, the system systematically filtered out any organized opposition.
Because political parties were strictly banned, candidates could only run as individuals approved by the state apparatus.
And even if a dissenting voice made it to the national legislature, their power was entirely superficial.
Because the Constitution explicitly stated that sovereignty was vested solely in the monarch.
King Mahendra retained absolute executive, legislative, and judicial veto power. He appointed the prime minister and the cabinet, he controlled the military, and he could overrule the Supreme Court.
It is absolute monarchy wrapped in the bureaucratic language of local governance.
But the Panchayat era wasn't just about political structure. It was a massive, aggressive project of cultural homogenization.
The regime recognized the deep ethnic and linguistic fractures in the country and attempted to pave over them with a single national identity.
The state ideology during the Panchayat era was codified in the slogan, Ek Raja, Ek Besh, Ek Baza, One King, One Dress, One Language.
The regime aggressively promoted a monocultural nationalism.
It enforced the Nepali language, which was the mother tongue of the ruling hill elites, as the sole language of education, administration, and broadcasting. Dozens of indigenous languages were marginalized.
They even mandated a national uniform. To work in the civil service or participate in government, individuals were required to wear the Dora Sudawal, the traditional dress of the hill aristocracy.
The state vigorously promoted Hinduism as the core of the national identity, heavily subsidizing Hindu temples and festivals while ignoring the cultural heritage of Buddhist and animist communities.
And the profound contradiction of the Panchayat system lies right here, doesn't it?
It does. It attempted to force a monoculture onto a deeply diverse demographic.
The Maluki Ain of 1854 had managed diversity through a strictly enforced hierarchy. The Panchayat system attempted to erase that diversity by forcing assimilation into the culture of the ruling elite.
By legally suppressing all political opposition and culturally marginalizing non-Nepali speakers and non-Hindu groups, the regime inadvertently laid the groundwork for severe militant ethnic and political mobilization in the future.
The pressure cooker is sealed again, and the pressure builds for nearly 30 years.
Eventually, the underground political parties, primarily the Nepali Congress and various communist factions, managed to coordinate.
In the spring of 1990, they launch a massive popular movement known as Jana Andolan.
Hundreds of thousands of people take to the streets in Kathmandu, enduring police violence to demand the end of the partyless system.
The 1990 movement succeeded. Facing overwhelming urban protests, King Birendra, who had succeeded Mahendra, conceded.
He lifted the ban on political parties, dissolved the Panchayat system, and agreed to assume the role of a constitutional monarch within a multi-party parliamentary democracy.
A new constitution was drafted and elections were held. On paper, it looks like the definitive triumph of democracy. The power is transferred from the palace to the parliament.
But the democratic governments of the 1990s quickly run into a massive structural wall.
They are holding elections, passing budgets, and arguing in parliament, but they are completely failing to dismantle the deep-rooted socioeconomic architecture that was constructed by the Maluki Ain back in 1854.
Right.
The abject rural poverty, the systemic caste discrimination against Dalits, the unequal distribution of agricultural land where high-caste landlords control the vast majority of the wealth, none of that fundamentally changes.
The political class in Kathmandu, even within the new democratic parties, were still overwhelmingly drawn from the traditional high-caste elite.
The rural populations, particularly the Janayatis in the Midwestern hills and the Dalits across the country, saw very little alteration in their daily lived realities.
The failure of the democratic establishment to deliver structural economic reform and social inclusion created a vast reservoir of rural disenfranchisement.
And that disenfranchisement is systematically weaponized.
On February 13, 1996, a radical splinter faction, the Communist Party of Nepal, Maoist, led by Pushpa Kamal Dahal, widely known by his nom de guerre, Prachanda launches an armed insurgency that they declare the People's War.
And they don't start their war in Kathmandu. They start it in the deeply impoverished remote western districts like Rolpa and Rukum. The Maoist insurgency deliberately targeted the historical fault lines of the state.
According to the sources, their manifesto explicitly called for the total dismantling of entrenched feudal structures, the abolition of the monarchy, and the establishment of a communist republic.
They successfully mobilized the populations that had been historically marginalized by the state apparatus.
They recruited heavily among the Janajati ethnic groups, who had been classified as alcohol drinkers and subjected to forced labor under the old codes, and among the Dalits, who had suffered centuries of codified untouchability.
They promised land redistribution, ethnic autonomy, and the overthrow of the high-caste landlords.
The conflict escalates into a brutal, grinding civil war that paralyzes the countryside.
The state responds with heavy militarization, deploying the Royal Nepal Army. The violence displaces hundreds of thousands of people and claims thousands of lives.
And right in the middle of this escalating war, the nation experiences a trauma so severe and unexpected that it fundamentally breaks the mystique of the monarchy.
On the evening of June 1, 2001, the Royal Palace in Kathmandu became the site of an unprecedented tragedy.
According to the official investigations, Crown Prince Ditendra, heavily intoxicated and reportedly enraged over a dispute regarding his marriage choice, armed himself with assault rifles and entered a family gathering.
He opens fire on his own family.
He assassinates his father, King Birendra, his mother, the queen, his siblings, and several other relatives before turning the weapon on himself.
The entire core of the royal family is wiped out in a matter of minutes. The psychological impact on the nation is just incalculable.
The monarchy had always been portrayed as a stabilizing, semi-divine institution. The massacre shatters that illusion of stability instantly.
The immediate consequence of the massacre was a crisis of succession. King Birendra's brother, Gyendra, who was not present at the gathering, assumes the throne.
King Gyendra inherited a nation in deep trauma, a failing economy, and an insurgency that controlled large swaths of the rural territory.
Unlike his brother, who had largely adhered to his constitutional role, Gyanendra favored a highly assertive, interventionist approach to the crisis.
He views the democratic politicians in parliament as corrupt and incapable of defeating the Maoists.
So on February 1, 2005, he repeats the actions of his father. He stages a royal coup.
He dismisses the prime minister, assumes absolute executive authority, declares a state of emergency, and suspends civil liberties.
He deploys the army to arrest mainstream political leaders, shuts down the press, and cuts off telephone and internet lines to the outside world.
He calculates that by centralizing all power in the palace, he can militarily crush the insurgency.
It is a critical miscalculation that highlights the limits of traditional statecraft in a modern context.
By executing the coup and suppressing the mainstream parliamentary political parties, King Gyanendra alienated the very forces that had historically supported the constitutional monarchy.
He left the democratic politicians with no space to operate within the legal framework of the state.
The irony is profound. He seizes power to crush the rebels, but his authoritarian overreach is the exact catalyst that forces his enemies to unite.
The mainstream democratic parties, furious at being imprisoned and sidelined, realize they share a common goal with the Maoist insurgents, the removal of the absolute monarchy.
They negotiate a 12-point agreement in New Delhi, officially allying the parliamentary parties with the Maoist rebels against King Gyanendra.
The king's attempt to isolate the insurgency results in the total isolation of the crown.
This alliance manifested in a massive coordinated uprising in April 2006, known as Jana Andolan II, or the Second People's Movement.
It was an unprecedented display of popular force. The Maoists enforced blockades in the countryside, while the mainstream parties mobilized millions of citizens to paralyze Kathmandu with 19 days of relentless strikes, curfews, and massive street protests.
The military and police simply could not contain the sheer volume of opposition. Facing total state collapse, King Gyanendra capitulated.
He reinstated the dissolved parliament and relinquished his absolute executive powers. This paves the way for the end of the civil war.
In November 2006, the government and the Maoists signed the Comprehensive Peace Accord.
The Maoists agree to put their weapons under United Nations supervision and enter mainstream politics. The decade-long insurgency is formally over.
But the fate of the nation's identity is left to a newly elected body. Elections are held for a constituent assembly, tasked with writing a new constitution and deciding the future of the monarchy.
When that Constituent Assembly held its first session on May 28, 2008, it represented a fundamental demographic shift.
The Assembly was the most inclusive political body in the nation's history, featuring unprecedented numbers of Janaratis, Dalits, and women.
The vote they cast that night was the culmination of everything we have discussed. Out of 564 members present, 560 voted in favor of a single resolution.
They vote to completely abolish the monarchy.
King Gyanendra is given 15 days to vacate the Narayanhiti Palace, which is promptly turned into a public museum.
A dynasty that was founded by Prithvi Narayan Shah in 1768, a monarchy that had unified the Himalayas, survived the British Empire, endured a century of Rana captivity, and navigated the Cold War, is dismantled by a legislative vote.
The Kingdom of Nepal officially becomes the Federal Democratic Republic of Nepal.
To fully grasp the magnitude of that transition, we cannot view the abolition of the monarchy merely as a sudden political event. It was the breaking of a massive, centuries-old social contract.
The Maoist insurgency, the popular uprisings, and the final vote to establish a republic were direct reactions to the deeply embedded structural inequalities that were legally codified by the 1854 Maluki Ain and the exclusionary cultural policies of the Panchayat era.
The political revolution was fundamentally an attempt to dismantle the social hierarchy engineered by the state centuries prior.
Looking back over this immense timeline from our sources, it is just staggering. We started with 54 squabbling hill fortresses. We watched Prithvi Narayan Shah use economic strangulation to build a unified buffer state against expanding empires.
We saw the intense violence of the Khat massacre birth a century of isolated hereditary oligarchy.
We examined how the Maluki Ain weaponized religious purity to control labor and diplomacy, and how the Panchayat system tried to force a monoculture onto a diverse nation.
And finally, we saw how the failure to address those historical injustices fueled a civil war that ultimately gave birth to a modern federal republic.
It leaves you with a profound consideration regarding the nature of power, legislation, and society.
We have seen how legal documents and social codes, like the Maluki Ain, cast massive shadows that dictate the trajectory of a nation long after the ink has dried, long after the regime that wrote them has fallen.
The formal institution of a monarchy, an entity that lasted for 240 years, can be legally abolished by a parliamentary vote in a single afternoon.
But dismantling a deeply codified social hierarchy, a system that has governed property, justice, daily labor, and human dignity for generations, is not something that can be achieved by a single election or a peace treaty. It requires a continuous, generational effort to rewire the fundamental mechanics of the state.
Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.